You're listening to a social justice podcast hosted by Nicholas Sperling, brought to you by The Flag Shop, and inspired by a social justice coloring book. Hello, this is a social justice podcast. I'm your host, Nicholas Sperling, and today I'm joined by Sarah Chown from AIDS Vancouver. Sarah, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, my name is Sarah Chown. I'm the executive director at AIDS Vancouver. My pronouns are she and her, and I have the pleasure of being a leader at AIDS Vancouver as a HIV negative settler on Coast Salish territories. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. And just to start things off, what is AIDS Vancouver and how did it come to be?
So in 1983, we were seeing here in Vancouver and elsewhere in the continent, a really surprising and unknown illness that was affecting what we knew at the time as a community of gay men. And there was a lot of concern and questions as folks were watching their friends get sick and a medical system that didn't know what to do in a time where there was a ton of homophobia really connected into the medical system. And so a really incredible group of leaders at the time came together to form the organization that's now, has been known as AIDS Vancouver for the first 40 years of our existence and is now known as Ribbon Community.
What services does Ribbon Community provide?
So right now we provide a whole mix of programs and services that support folks living with HIV, as well as people who are HIV negative and want support or services to provide empowerment as they navigate substance use and sex in the context of the HIV epidemic. And those services include a really incredible peer navigator program that exists at some of the HIV clinics locally and in the Surrey area, and also with the Rapid Access Addictions Clinic at St. Paul's.
Amazing. And what was once called GRID, or gay-related immune deficiency, then became known as AIDS, which obviously informed the name of the society. And now we seem to talk a lot about HIV. So can you explain some of this terminology? Is AIDS the same as HIV? I think these are the kinds of questions that our audience probably is not familiar with.
Yeah, a great question, Nicola. And I think this is one of the places that we still continue to see HIV stigma pop up, is the misinformation around those changes that happened pretty rapidly in the first few years of what we now call the HIV epidemic. But, you know, many of us have been slow to stay on top of that information, especially as the, you know, public education dollars really dried up as we saw the shift towards HIV. So I can talk a little bit about those three acronyms that you mentioned.
Sure, that'd be great.
So the GRID acronym was one of the first ones before we had the acronym AIDS. And that was, again, one of the reasons that we had this stigma connected to homophobia showing up. So what was happening from the perspective of physicians and the medical response was otherwise healthy, primarily young gay men were getting very sick very quickly, and nothing that we had available at the time was helping people get well. And we saw hundreds of deaths as a result of that very early on. And all that the medical system could see was that the one thing that everybody has in common is that they're gay. And so that's what led to gay-related immune disorder, or GRID. And as science, like scientific people who can look at things under a microscope, started to look at the situation, they were able to see that this like disorder, which was sort of renamed AIDS, was caused by a virus, which is where we got HIV. So it went from GRID, then it was, okay, it's not only that people are gay that this is impacting. Mm-hmm. And so we can say that it's an acquired acquired syndrome. So ACE in AIDS stands for acquired, and then immune deficiency. So it was impacting people's immune system, and then syndrome, which is a fancy word that means it's a collection of things. It's not just a specific set every single time. So it's sort of, there's a long list of things. And if you had three or four of those things, then you might be diagnosed with AIDS. But the three or four things that were going on for me might be different than the three or four things that were going on for you. All of those things affected our immune system.
Right. And it's sort of interesting because that acronym changed from GRID to AIDS pretty early on within the first few years, right?
Yeah.
And yet that idea that it was a disease of gay people persisted long after that. I mean, even to this day, a lot of people will associate AIDS or HIV with the queer community. Do you know why that persisted in that way?
Yeah, so I mean, it's hard to know exactly. I'm too young to have been there at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. I think some of the things that we can talk about, or like when we talk about this, I think a huge part is to think about the way that race and health and access to medical expertise really played out too. So we know that what we now call HIV was circulating in parts of Africa for a very long time prior to emerging here in Vancouver, specifically for the work that I do. And it wasn't seen as something unique or different because of the burden of illness that was experienced in those places at that time. And it wasn't really until that virus was affecting people who were otherwise healthy and otherwise expected to live into their 70s and 80s that it sort of piqued curiosity. And so I think that's like a part of when we talk about the beginning of the HIV crisis in the 80s that is important to contextualize of how this was affecting places outside North America long before that.
I want to sort of paint this picture for the audience of what the climate was like when your organization was formed. So in the 80s, to live as a gay man, I imagine when you're hearing about all these people that are getting sick and that are dying, it has to be extremely scary and heartbreaking to lose friends. And it was right after a period of time, from what I understand, between the Stonewall riots and the equivalent here in Canada and the AIDS epidemic, there was sort of this time where it was actually okay. It was pretty good for queer people at the time. And then that took a dive again in the 80s. So are you able to provide some insights of what that looked like?
Yeah, so there's a really incredible project that was made here in British Columbia called the HIV in My Day Project that I really encourage folks to check out for way better context than I'll ever be able to provide on that. It's housed at the University of Victoria and has sort of tried to answer this question. So over the past few years, they've been speaking with folks who were living in Vancouver or Victoria or other parts of the province in that time period that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And asked about what that time was like and what was happening. And from my perspective, as someone who's gotten to listen to those interviews and get to know a lot of folks who are still alive today and have made it possible for our organization to still exist, I think, yeah, it was a really scary time of, you know, homophobia is real and there's lots of different pieces going on within communities about, you know, who was welcome and some of those questions that we still see playing out today. Mm-hmm. And with this added reality of, and then some people were just very sick and then dead and people didn't really know why. And a lot of the services that already existed didn't know what to do, including, you know, our medical system that was like putting on gowns and gloves and masks at a time that was really atypical before walking into the room when people were being told there's nothing we can do and your partner's not able to be here while you die because of, you know, all of these different reasons that they're not close family. So, you know, that connection between a society that didn't really fully accept, you know, gay men and their partners and the queer women and trans folks and like such a huge community that really mobilized when people were sick really meant that time was even made even worse by some of those pieces and stories of, you know, people passing away and the entire funeral and all of that happening without that person's partner ever even being part of it. So yeah, like strong connections that we still, you know, that are part of why we see this, you know, real connection in some ways between HIV and queer communities, but also some of the ways that it, you know, the HIV stigma was reinforced by homophobia and homophobia was reinforced by HIV.
Right. And I imagine there must have been a huge amount of loneliness as well when you think about the fact that people didn't know how this was being transmitted and there was this fear of even touching gay people. So is that something that people still have trauma from or that there was a significant amount of trauma around at the time?
One of the things that I think is so helpful to talk about in the work that we do today at Ribbon Community and how we think about HIV prevention is that it was actually people living with HIV who founded HIV prevention. Folks who were living with HIV who were maybe expecting to die, some of whom did die, navigating a really challenging medical system, who were like, we don't want this to happen to other people. Mm-hmm. What can we do? And so there's a really incredible legacy of that work. There's a famous booklet called How to Have Sex in an Epidemic that talks about what are the strategies that we can use, in part so that we can have sex in ways that feels good in our communities and allows us to take care of each other, and in part to address that loneliness that you mentioned of losing access to physical touch or sexual relationships, and intimacy expressed in that way was one of the really challenging things for folks living with HIV then, and one of the areas where we still see a huge amount of HIV stigma when we're talking to queer people today. And so that looks like people saying things like, I'm not having sex with someone who's HIV positive, which we know there's many incredible, pleasurable, fun, intimate ways of having sex with folks living with HIV if we are HIV negative and never having any risk that HIV is passed. And that's one of the key messages that we really, as we've embraced this new name and our new values and our new purpose statement at Ribbon Community, really want to get out there. HIV negative people can have sex with HIV positive people, and there is absolutely no risk of HIV being passed in certain situations where medications are involved and a viral load is undetectable.
Right. And I mean, when you say absolutely no risk, that means that it's even more effective than a condom preventing pregnancy, for instance.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the, so the campaign that I'm referencing was also built by people living with HIV, and it's called Undetectable Equals Untransmissible, or U equals U for short, I equals I in Spanish. It's based on really clear scientific evidence that we have over years and years that when a person living with HIV is taking their treatment called antiretrovirals as prescribed by their doctor and has been doing so for at least 6 months and has an undetectable viral load, which is what we would expect in those circumstances, there is absolutely not a risk that HIV can be passed. And it's super important that we use that really clear language and mm-hmm. make comparisons like, that's more effective than a condom, to really drive home the fact that it is possible when we're able to have those conversations with sex partners and get that information and understand how that fits in.
I mean, we'll get to, I think, present day, what the organization's doing. I still want to set up a little bit of that history.
Of course.
One of the other questions I have for you is Paul Popham. Who was Paul, and what is the gay men's health crisis, or what was that?
Great question. I can tell you've been watching our 30-30 videos.
I have. Huge recommendation for anyone in our audience. Go check out those videos. They're absolutely incredible. I've been loving every single one. Love is sort of an odd word to use for it because they are heartbreaking, but they're very well done, very informative.
So Paul, again, watch the videos for hearing the words directly from Paul and others who were there at the time. But Paul was part of the Gay Men's Health Crisis, which was founded in New York City. And he actually came to Vancouver in 1983 at something that was called The Forum as a person living with HIV who was really concerned about what was happening and was invited here to Vancouver by the founders of AIDS Vancouver to have a conversation about what he was seeing in New York City, where there was more at the time AIDS diagnoses than we were seeing here. And also as somebody who had founded an organization that was responding to what gay men were experiencing at that time, which was a health crisis. And so by coming here, you know, in a time where that was arranged by a telephone call and people hadn't met Paul personally before, Paul was able to share with gay men here in Vancouver some of the lessons learned in New York City and some of the things that, you know, some of the actions that could be undertaken here. And all of that really led to making AIDS Vancouver a reality in 1983 and still up until today.
Right. So that was sort of the birth almost of AIDS Vancouver in that case.
Yeah, definitely.
Amazing. And another person that I think we need to talk about is
Gaetan Dugas. Yeah.
Dugas?
Yeah.
A person who was labeled patient zero. And we learned about this in the Really Gay History Tour as well. We actually had Forbidden Vancouver as one of our guests on a previous podcast. They have a tour called the Really Gay History Tour. They talk about how patient zero, which is from everyone's understanding, the first person to have AIDS in North America, right? Because as you point out, that existed in Africa prior. But in North America, this was the first person. They were a flight attendant moving around, and that was part of what started the spread locally. He was quite involved in these discussions in Vancouver with Paul Popham. Your organization formed in 1983. He unfortunately passed away in 1984. And I'm curious to know, did your organization have interactions with him? And if so, what did that look like?
Great question. I think part of what I'll say, to be honest, is I wasn't there in 1983.
Right,
and we don't have great records of what was happening. So I can't really speak super specifically to the relationship between AIDS Vancouver and Gaytan. What I can talk about is the fact that, you know, in one of those first films about the founding of AIDS Vancouver, there's some really important folks in the HIV movement here who talked about that a little bit and who did a few things. First, I think really refuted the idea, like challenged the idea that patient zero was ever a helpful label, challenged the idea that HIV was passed through our communities rapidly as a direct result of one individual, and also talked about some of the tensions that we still experience today around what I was just talking about, in this idea that folks living with HIV have the same sexual rights as folks who are HIV negative. There's also a lot of fear and shame and stigma among among HIV negative people who want to stay HIV negative and who want that responsibility to lie with someone else. And so, you know, Gaytan, when I think about Gaytan, when I think about what I've read about Gaytan and what I've listened to in films and podcasts about Gaytan, he's such an example of the worst parts of our movement in some ways, or like how he was treated, how he was talked about.
Right.
Not him as a
individual. There was so much
individual.
Stigma around like, patient zero, right?
Exactly, yeah. And how he was treated, and, you know, even in the videos about AIDS Vancouver from the 3030 playlist that we were just talking about, he was in an incredibly difficult position of, you know, having this, in some ways, a target on his back as like the person who could change what was happening with HIV, but it was never just Gaytan. And I think it's something that we'll never really know. As you said, Gaytan passed away very early in the history of AIDS Vancouver and also very early in the context of the HIV epidemic.
Right.
So there's so much that we'll never get to know about how Gaytan may have contributed to the organization. But his notoriety is certainly connected to this like HIV stigma and shame that so many of us still grapple with today. And I think it matters how we try to challenge some of those takes. One of the books that I think really most specifically tells this history of Gaytan Dugas is called The Band Played On. And it's really been debunked and sort of removed from many of the reading lists of folks that want to show up in the HIV movement in a way that respects and honors the incredible work and leadership of folks living with HIV, which can't always happen when we're targeting one person. And yeah, like in 1983, we didn't really know how HIV was passed in some ways. So it's also like sort of ridiculous in the context of the scientific information we actually had at the time to be thinking that this was related to just one person.
Right. And I think there's this idea that Patient Zero or Gaytan brought HIV to North America and gave it to all of these people, when in reality, he was just as much a victim as anyone else.
Mm.
He didn't ask to get HIV, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that we would treat someone that way is odd to me. Like, it would be like saying the person who brought COVID from China over to North America is responsible for everyone in North America getting it. And that we obviously don't do that. There's some people out there who blame China for this. But anyone who has gotten COVID knows that these types of things spread and there's not a whole lot that you can do about it. So do you think that we have, I guess, evolved to the point of knowing better now, or do we still fall into those types of traps?
What a great question, Nicola. You know, I would love to say that we know better and therefore we do better. And I think the example you just used around COVID is a really sad example of how we didn't really do that much better, right? Like the anti-Chinese racism that has increased significantly, especially in the early days of that pandemic. Mm-hmm. You know, that's very similar to the like patient zero HIV stigma that Gaytan and a few others, but like primarily Gaytan experienced at that time. And, you know, very similar parallels of at the beginning, we didn't know that much about what we, you know, there was a time where we were like not going outside in case we walked past someone on the sidewalk who might have COVID, right? And similar with HIV, there was a time that people would not hug a person living with HIV or drop food off in a room of somebody living with HIV without gowns and gloves and masks. And so I think still today, while, you know, our organization and many of our partners across the province and the country do really incredible work to try to challenge that HIV stigma, we still hear from folks who their roommate finds out they have HIV and they're told to use their own specific plate and set of cutlery and cooking instruments, which comes from this place of not understanding how HIV is passed because we don't talk about it. So it's not the fault of individual people who are saying, I'm really scared of getting HIV and why don't you just use your own plate and your own cutlery and that will keep me HIV negative. That person often doesn't know better because we haven't told folks better, right? And so part of what we're really trying to do is be really clear that it's very specific ways that pass HIV, and most of the ways that we spend most of our time for most of us don't actually pass HIV. I can't get HIV using the washroom after somebody living with HIV. I can't get HIV in sitting here with you doing this podcast. You know, we need to have a body fluid that has a high amount of HIV in it come into direct contact with our bloodstream for there to be a possibility that HIV could even be passed. And I don't know about you or folks that are listening, but, you know, most of the time, I know if somebody's body fluid is coming into direct contact with my bloodstream. And right. So, you know, thinking about that specifically and making sure folks really understand that is one of the ways we can challenge that stigma. I think the other thing that I'd highlight here is that in Canada, we still have a criminal justice system that charges people living with HIV with aggravated sexual assault in situations where they might have sex with an HIV negative person, even when there's no possibility that HIV can be passed. And that's a criminal charge that is based on this idea of needing to protect people who are HIV negative from people who are HIV positive. So yeah, like I think that's an example of how we're not doing better at all.
And does that apply to other forms of sexually transmitted infections?
So that's an emerging area of sort of how this is playing out in the legal system. And there's currently some really important work being led by folks living with HIV, and there has been for the just over 10 years I've gotten to work in this space. I'm trying to change those, like the ways that the criminal system responds in these situations of what's called HIV non-disclosure. And so one of the options on the table is thinking about if that should apply to other types of sexually transmitted infections or bloodborne infections, but that's not currently the case.
Oh, so it's just if you are HIV positive.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very strange, especially when you consider that other STIs are transmitted far more easily than someone who is protecting themselves and has HIV.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that, you know, folks living with HIV live on average the same lifespan as folks who are HIV negative. So much of our systematic response to HIV is still stuck in a place of what we knew in 1983, which is somebody is diagnosed and somebody will very likely die very quickly. And when we have access to the incredible medical care that is overall available here in British Columbia, that's not happening. And, you know, keywords there being access to that medical care. But, you know, medical care keeps people living with HIV alive and healthy and well in a way that wasn't dreamed of in 1983.
Right. And I'm thinking about these parallels between HIV and COVID. And I'm remembering in the early days of the COVID pandemic when people were not able to see their loved ones who were maybe in a hospital or were in care homes, something along those lines. And those people were dying alone. And it really does make you wonder how far have we actually come, which is sad. But at least our medical system has come a long way. And now people are living, like you said, full, long lives, even with HIV. So moving more into the present day, you talked about how AIDS Vancouver is now the Ribbon Community organization. So how did you go about, or why did you go about changing the name?
Great question. So I started at well, Ribbon Community, formerly known as AIDS Vancouver, in July 2022. And part of what I was sort of given as an opportunity in that role was to think about and consider the question that many people had been asking about AIDS Vancouver for a long time of, is it time to change our name? That question came from so many different places. One of the pieces that's really important is that we haven't only served Vancouver for a very long time. So Vancouver, I think people say, oh, you're AIDS Vancouver, you must work in Vancouver. That makes sense. And so we spent a lot of time explaining the work we did, you know, in other parts of the Lower Mainland primarily. And also, you know, there's been a few different ways that we've been able to support work outside the Lower Mainland. So that's one of those pieces, is the geographic aspect of the name. And then also thinking a little bit about the relationships we're building with Indigenous folks. And so, you know, having an English place name in this context also was one of the questions. The really big question comes around AIDS. So in 1983, that was the very best language we had to describe what we now call HIV. And both exist still in 2024. We both have HIV. Again, as a reminder, the virus that can be passed between people that, if left untreated for years, can develop into AIDS. We do have both, but when we say AIDS, it evokes so much of what was happening in 1983, which is people are scared of AIDS, people are scared of dying of AIDS, and we still have a small number of AIDS deaths here in British Columbia, and it's important to recognize the impact that AIDS has in those situations. And by and large, what's happening is folks are living long, healthy lives with HIV and are dying at an older age than they ever expected from a cardiac issue or from cancer or from being old, which isn't something that people expected in 1983. And so we got to, in the time that I've been at Ribbon Community, we got to talk to our communities, all of the folks that make up our organization that come through our doors for our wide range of programs and services, hear from folks about what they wanted. Was it time to change the name? So in February of 2023, we went to our legal membership and asked, do we have support to have a consultation process where we will look at revising our mission and our vision and our names and our values? And members said yes. So then we got to talk to people and ask those questions. What do people like about where we are now? What would people like to change? How do you feel about the name? What would you like to see more of? What's most important to you? And some of the things we heard over and over again is that it's so important to have an HIV-specific organization, particularly for folks that have been living with HIV for decades. We heard that message really clearly from folks who've been diagnosed more recently. We heard that it's really hard in those early stages of identity formation around HIV to walk into a space and not really be sure if everybody was going through the same thing as you or just some people. And so from that perspective, we heard it was important to remain HIV specific. And then we also heard about the stigma. We heard that folks were like, I really like coming to this program. And my friends are like, oh, it seemed like you had a really fun evening. Like, where were you? What were you doing? And when folks then have to say AIDS Vancouver, it's an immediate outing of their HIV status.
Right.
Even though we support and empower folks who are HIV positive and HIV negative, just saying AIDS Vancouver has the assumption that a person is living with HIV. And so we wanted a name that was clearly connected to the history of HIV and the important legacy that's been created by folks living with HIV, without putting people in a position of having to say, oh, like, just some organization, I'm not really sure, like, can't tell you about it. That then becomes super awkward if it's like somebody that you care about. So we wanted a name that did both, and we're really excited to be finally talking publicly about the name that we've settled on, Ribbon Community. And for folks who might not know, how does Ribbon connect to the history of AIDS Vancouver, or why Ribbon? In 1991, there was a group of artists that who were primarily living with HIV who came together and created what has become an international symbol of HIV, which is the red ribbon. And so while we chose not to have red ribbon as our name, why we chose ribbon specifically is it creates, for folks who know that we're connected to HIV, who know the history of that symbol, which was the first health-related ribbon that was ever created.
Oh, interesting.
Folks might connect ribbon to HIV, but for folks, like, if you don't want your aunt to know, your aunt will probably hear ribbon community. My aunt heard ribbon community and said, well, how is that connected to HIV? Which is what we want folks who we don't necessarily want to know right away. Right. We want that to be ambiguous. And we also really are honoring and doing our very best to honor the folks that came before us, the folks whose leadership in 1983 made it possible for us to be here today, the folks who passed away between 1983 and now, and the folks who never got the chance to lead at our organization. And keeping that connection to HIV is essential as we move into this era of the way that we support and empower our communities around responding to HIV and also HIV stigma. So we really heard over and over again that, yeah, HIV is a virus and it affects my life, but it's actually the stigma. It's actually being unsure if I should tell my aunt or my friend or my teacher that I went to a great event that's right. related to HIV. It's being concerned about having sex and how to have sex ethically in the context of so many people experiencing rejection when they say I'm living with HIV, even though in many of those cases, there's no risk HIV can be passed. And so folks have to choose between maybe I don't say that and then I'll have sex and nothing will change in the risk, but everything will change in whether or not I'm signing up to experience rejection today or if I just get to, you know, have the same sort of pleasure and sexual experiences as folks who are HIV negative. So those are some of our biggest hopes and dreams in changing our name and some of the pieces we're really trying to honor in this phase of our organization.
Right. And as you're explaining all of this around why that change is necessary, it makes so much sense. And at the same time, I'm wondering, when it comes to honoring that history, were there people that were pushing back and saying, no, we don't want this name to change. We have some sort of attachment to it.
Yeah, really clear attachment to the, you know, the name AIDS Vancouver. And again, like, we have clients, I've talked to a client today who's been coming through our doors for, if not 40 years, 37.5, and has always come to AIDS Vancouver. And AIDS Vancouver has been a huge part of the, like, both the organization has been a huge part of folks' lives in that name, but also the way that AIDS specifically has shaped the lives of folks. And, you know, we have many folks today who are given an AIDS diagnosis and expected to pass away and now are working at our organization or volunteering at our organization or accessing the grocery program at our organization or, you know, helping us with some of the education and anti-stigma initiatives that we have. And so for some of those folks, losing AIDS specifically is a loss. And as we are excited about our name, we're also really recognizing the grief that this change in particular causes. And so we are very intentional about the fact that we will continue to show up for folks living with HIV, including folks that either have an AIDS diagnosis now or have had an AIDS diagnosis years ago that continues to shape their life. And I think there was one person in particular who I talked to who said, yeah, you know, I'm sad. I'm sad about this and I'm going to be sad. And I know it's the right thing. I can recognize that it's the right thing, but it doesn't take away the sad. And so that's part of what we're trying to hold in this too, is as the communities that are most affected by HIV change, partly because of the advances we're seeing medically, we also want to shift as an organization to ensure we're really welcoming to the communities who we haven't always done a great job of serving. In many cases, those communities are folks that experience more intense HIV stigma and for whom having to say AIDS Vancouver or even having to walk through the doors or phone our blocked number that's associated with AIDS Vancouver really prevents people from accessing our services.
Right. Well, and speaking of name changes and organizations going through that process, we recently had Health Initiative for Men on the podcast, who has the acronym HIM. And we had this long conversation about how Health Initiative for Men isn't just for men. It's for you too, right? Mm-hmm. And there's so much explaining that had to be done. And even once people understand this is for me, even though I'm not a man, there's still that stigma associated with it. And so Aaron Purdy was talking about how that organization is trying to go through these changes and how it's a big struggle. And I also know that your organization works pretty closely with Health Initiative for Men. And we had conversations on that episode about HIV and AIDS. So can you talk about what your relationship with him looks like?
Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest ways that we're working with him right now is through our work to ensure that the newest innovations in HIV medications around long-acting medication is available here in British Columbia. So that's one of our biggest collaborations and a lot of places where we're really working to, educate our teams together so that we have up-to-date information that we can offer folks living with HIV and HIV negative folks who also stand to benefit from long-acting prevention options that are coming. We also collaborate on a number of harm reduction initiatives related to ensuring our communities broadly have access to condoms and access to various safer injecting and safer smoking supplies. And one of the areas that we do that is around our sex work programs. And then as one of the biggest providers of STI testing, we see a ton of folks in our programs who are also accessing HIM clinics. And so it's a really great relationship in that we can refer folks who are accessing our programs and services to him, either for counseling, which is something that we don't currently provide, or testing, which is something we don't currently provide outside of HIV self-tests. And so really having that referral relationship is really helpful. And then we also have had the opportunity to collaborate on some programs together and have, what they're doing at him help us think about our programming at Ribbon Community and vice versa. So that opportunity to work as colleagues and look at what we're seeing in our communities, look at what's working from a program delivery model, and then adapt in that way has been really helpful as well. And then I think some of what you've mentioned around, we really are big supporters as HIM is going through this process of thinking about the acronym HIM and what that means in 2024, similar to what we've been doing, which we mostly did in 2023, but are talking about publicly now in 2024 around, mm-hmm. What does AIDS mean in 2024 is certainly different than when it was founded.
Right. Absolutely. You've talked a little bit about the services that your organization offers. Can you elaborate on how those services have evolved over the years? I imagine the type of services that you're offering and the type of care that people need looks different today than it did 40 years ago.
Yeah. So first thing, I did a terrible job of answering the question at the beginning about what we do. I talked about one of our programs, which is one of many. So our peer navigation program is actually one of the newest programs at Ribbon Community, but not the longest standing one. So some of the other services that we provide and have provided since the beginning of AIDS Vancouver is a grocery program. So we know that folks living with HIV often are living on fixed incomes and like many people in 2024 are struggling to make groceries happen. And so
is this because of age? Like the people who were experiencing that in the 80s are now at the age where they're relying on those fixed incomes?
Yeah. So some of the reasons are related to age and so folks who have are on fixed income related to age, whether that's a pension or like any of the public system pieces around that. We also work with a lot of folks who are on income assistance or ministry assistance in one way or another.
Right.
While HIV itself is not a disability designatable health condition in 2024, there are a lot of things that can happen at the same time as HIV, mm-hmm. whether that's anxiety and depression or substance use disorder that can lead to that designation. So okay. We certainly do that. And then we also work with a huge number of newcomers to Canada who are often not able to work because of how work permits are distributed and how that system works overall, or who are only allowed to work a very limited number of hours. So those are some of the reasons why folks might be on fixed incomes.
Okay.
And then one of the things about most of the HIV medications that are currently available now is that many of them need to be taken with food. So we've had a grocery program that's existed for, since the beginning of our organization. And that's open 28 weeks a year, so two or three times a month, and folks are able to access a variety of fresh food and pantry items. We also have a social work-led case management program that works with HIV-positive folks and HIV-negative folks around sort of supporting and empowering people to navigate the systems that are out there. So for folks living with HIV, some of what we do is help people, you know, identify the HIV care, like what clinic do they want to go to? How can they get there? Do they have questions for their doctor that they want to make sure to ask? We also work with a lot of forms and applications, whether that's for ministry assistance or GIS supplements from the federal government, all of those types of things we handle in our office. We can provide support around folks navigating First Nations status and access to benefits can come through that. We provide support around substance use and mental health and psychosocial support. So all of that can happen in our case management program. And then that program also works with HIV negative folks to really get to have conversations with people about sex or use substances in ways that includes having HIV risk. And so talking with people about, hey, you know, you're saying that you're not feeling great about that sex that you're having, or you've really struggled to get information about how you can have sex with somebody who's HIV positive and know there's no risk there. Let's help you break that information down, or, you know, figure out a testing routine that feels good and accessible, or talk to your doctor about gender affirming care or safer supply or prescribed alternatives. That's all work that our case management team does. And then we also have some Indigenous programs, as so many of the folks that we work with are Indigenous and want a place to learn how to bead or to drum. We host pipe ceremonies with the change of the seasons led by one of our community members. And then we also do broader community programs that are always a mix of community and food and fun, and providing information about HIV today and navigating, you know, whatever it may be that folks are navigating, and a whole host of peer support groups that happen in a few different languages and are available through our services.
And I mean, I want to come back to that Indigenous piece in a second, but I'm also curious to know about, when it comes to HIV negative people, are we talking about your organization serving everyone? You know, you have people who have HIV and people who don't have HIV. It sounds like we're talking about the entire population. Or are we talking about people that may be HIV negative but are in relationships with people who are HIV positive or have some other relationship to HIV in that way?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So that's one of the areas that, as an organization called AIDS Vancouver, you can imagine HIV negative people weren't flocking to our doors and seeing themselves reflected in that name. And that's part of what we're hoping our new name as Ribbon Community does. It's pretty vague. It's open to everyone. In terms of the specific services that we currently provide to folks who are HIV negative, there's sort of two places that that happens. One is through the work that we do with Providence Health at St. Paul's Hospital through the Rapid Access Addictions Clinic. That clinic is open to anybody who wants access to substance use support. Mm-hmm. And so there's some HIV positive people in that space, also HIV negative folks, but we're not asking people's status at the door of that clinic for obvious reasons. That clinic is really there to provide support around substance use, and we get the great opportunity of having peers in that space, while our lovely colleagues who are nurses and doctors and social workers can, you know, provide that medical support that can be so helpful for folks navigating substance use disorders. So that's one area. And in that space, again, it's like HIV status isn't the primary organizing factor, and we work with folks who are positive or negative. In terms of the case management that we provide for folks who are HIV negative, that's really, it is both for anybody who's HIV negative, and it's the and part, who wants to talk about how or if HIV prevention makes sense for them. Mm-hmm. So for folks who are HIV negative and are like, I don't have an HIV risk, I don't need any information about HIV, our case management program isn't the right fit. But for folks who are HIV negative and are asking questions that I think many of us do, of like, I heard that eating chocolate, drinking wine, sitting at my desk for too many hours isn't very healthy or has some risk attached to it, mm-hmm. but I still want to do those things. So how can I do that in a, you know, a harm reduction lens, I heard that driving in my car means that there could be a car accident. I wear a seatbelt, right? So those are sort of silly examples in some ways, but that is really the model that we're working from. It's everything that we do, somebody somewhere has, you know, proven how there could be a risk attached to that. And so we take that model and we apply it to HIV. So, okay, yeah, having sex, things can happen. You could have an STI, you could get pregnant, you could get HIV. Most people don't stop having sex because of those things. And I would say that models that say stop, like stop having sex because of those things tend not to work. And so what our team gets to do is be like, okay, you know, what part makes you feel anxious? What level of risk feels acceptable to you? And then provides people from, you know, an empowerment model, the information to be like, you, again, in these specific situations that we've talked about, if you're HIV negative and you have an HIV positive sex partner who's taking medications regularly, who has an undetectable viral load and has been in that place for 6 months or more, there's not a risk of HIV, especially for folks who have never heard that before. Folks usually are like, I've never heard of that. That seems wrong and I don't get it. And everything I've been taught is not to have sex with somebody who's living with HIV. And so our team gets to, you know, work with people through that because we know, you know, there's lots of examples where just having a fact doesn't lead to changed behavior. And so we get to do that as one example.
Right. Coming back to that Indigenous piece that you'd mentioned and wanting to work on, I guess, building relationships and working towards reconciliation of some kind. What are you doing to consult Indigenous people? What feedback are you receiving? What changes are you making?
We currently work with a really incredible Indigenous committee that meets every other week. And there are folks that currently use our services or have used our services in the past. And they do like quite a lot of different things, including telling me that until our reception team is staffed by Indigenous people, it's going to be really hard for Indigenous people to walk through our doors, right? And so that's a direct piece of feedback that we have heard from that committee. That committee has also helped us with our hiring processes. So most of our hiring, I won't say not quite all, but most of our hiring over the past year or so has had an Indigenous person as part of that decision making, which is, you know, one of the things that they have identified. And then, you know, really welcoming Indigenous people into our space through some of the cultural programs that we've talked about. And then, you know, really supporting and empowering this committee and some of our the Indigenous staff that are on our team to create some space for us to do that. One of the things that we've most recently done is we have a financial assistance fund that's for current Ribbon community clients. And there's a few different categories. There's always been four. And this year we added like culturally affirming items or practices category. So folks can apply for up to $150 to purchase regalia that they need to participate in a ceremony or to purchase medicine or to work with an elder or basically anything that folks might be identifying, transportation to cultural ceremonies. That those are some of the things that we've been able to provide there. And that really came from what we've been hearing over and over again from our Indigenous committee, which is connection and the importance of accessing culture as part of people's wellness, whether folks are living with HIV or not.
Right. The more you talk about things that you're doing, the more I realize the organization sounds huge. You do so much. What are we talking about in terms of the size and capacity of the organization?
Great question. So we're, you know, give or take around 20 staff that are working 4 days a week and then a whole team of part-time folks, primarily peer navigators, who are usually the ones with the best ideas around some of these pieces around, you know, it's really important. I am a person who's living with HIV would be something a peer navigator would say. I am an Indigenous person and, you know, I don't feel like I have the things that I need to participate in my culture or to access gender-affirming care, which is the other category that we added to that fund as a direct result of those conversations with our Indigenous committee and our clients. So like our team is sort of around 40 people, depending on how you measure, you know, FTE equivalents and things like that. Right. But, you know, it's a big organization.
That's amazing. And I guess 40 years is a long time to grow capacity and do all of that great work. Mm. With that in mind, what is your hope for the future of, I guess, now not AIDS Vancouver, but Ribbon Community?
Mm-hmm. So our new purpose statement that we came to that really sort of led to the change in name as well is that we support and empower our communities in overcoming the impacts of HIV and HIV stigma. So when I think about that as a purpose, I get like so excited about what's possible when, you know, HIV negative people get out of the way a little bit. And that's a bit of a message to myself as an HIV negative person who gets to have this incredible leadership role. But thinking about my role as one that makes space for the great things that folks living with HIV are doing now and have been doing since the very beginning of HIV. And when I think about that, I think about the tremendous changes that that would lead to in the ways that, in particular, queer communities have sex, but also, you know, folks who might be outside of that. You know, if we didn't have so much fear of HIV built into sex and substance use, like how would that help our conversations in an education way shift, you know, mm-hmm. at a systems level? How would that help shift, you know, the initial sexual experiences of queer communities? I think about what languages we would work in. So our team has something like a dozen languages represented, wow. particularly among our peer navigators, yet most of the work that we do is in English. So we think about, you know, what would be possible if there was an executive director who spoke more than just English. I'm really excited about the work that we're currently doing around language diversity on our team and how we deliver those services. And I just think there's infinite potential around what that means as we continue to welcome more and more newcomers to Vancouver and British Columbia who are living with HIV, needing to provide services in more than one language. And then I just think like HIV stigma influences so much of the world that we live in, even when we might not know that. And I think, you know, one of the ways that I start HIV education workshops when I lead them is like, what do people know about HIV on a scale of 0 to 5? And folks so often are like, oh, I know like 0 or 1 or 2. So I don't know a lot. You need to share some information with me. And I use that as this opportunity to say, if you know 0 or 1 or 2, what you know is like Matthew McConaughey's character in Dallas Buyers Club and that scene in that television show where they didn't entirely get the right information about HIV.
Right.
We really need to help people have access to all that information about HIV. And that means we need to start conversations like outside of a place of fear, right? We need to get everyone to the point in time where someone says, this is my name and I'm living with HIV. And we say, hey, welcome. Thanks for sharing that. Like, my name's Sarah, I'm a queer person, and that's an important part of who I am, right? So thinking about that in those ways, rather than what we continue to see of, well, maybe you should use your own plate today, or I'm not really sure if your opinion or perspective is valid, or that medical thing that you're navigating, that's probably just related to HIV, and so I might not be able to help you with that if I'm not an HIV doctor. So I think those are some of the places that I think about. I also think about our value. We nurture meaningful involvement of people living with HIV, and I think about what could change in this province if the HIV policy world also embraced that value, where people living with HIV were getting to make decisions about what medications are available and how and when, or we're consulted in that as a starting point. I think about what it would mean for people living with HIV to teach all our nurses and doctors and healthcare professionals about what it means to be on the receiving end of an HIV diagnosis or the receiving end of information that might be a little bit scary about HIV. And those are some of the things that I hope we can do together as Ribbon Community into the future.
Fantastic. So a lot of great goals for the future. And I ask this question in every podcast episode, but what can our audience do to help? Mm-hmm. So when it comes to this topic, I'm thinking, you know, what can the audience do to help your organization specifically, or maybe to reduce the stigma around HIV? Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
The best invitation that I can make to the audience of the podcast is to share one fact about HIV in your life this week, and one next week, and one the week after that. for folks who aren't used to talking about HIV, it's like, oh, well, Sarah, why are you talking about HIV? When I first started doing this work, you know, after a few years, my parents started to joke that they would think something was wrong with me if I hadn't brought up HIV at the dinner table after two or three nights of visiting with my parents. And my dinner table growing up didn't talk about HIV. And I'm so grateful for my parents who have come a very long way. But I think about, you know, what would it mean to be able to have your dinner time conversation of how was your day? What were some of the things that happened? Oh, yeah, like I learned this thing about HIV, and then move on to like, I also went down the slide at recess and it was a lot of fun. Or, you know, this thing happened with my girlfriend or my boyfriend and I don't know what to do, right? So like to think about that in this way that allows us all to learn or to offer a fact about HIV the way that we might be like, did you see what's happening in the news? So yeah, I think honest conversations that are based on facts about HIV, not fear, is one of the biggest things that we can all contribute as we work to address HIV stigma, support and empower folks living with HIV to access services like what we offer at Ribbon Community and live the wonderful, beautiful lives that are possible as a result of all of the 40 years that we're building upon in who we are and how we show up today.
Right. And I mean, one of the things that I always recommend to people too is education, educate yourself.
Yes.
And we mentioned that 30-30 campaign earlier.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever mentioned what exactly that meant. So
yes,
that meant 30 years and a video for each of those years, right?
Yeah. So in 2013, a group called Be the Change Group and AIDS Vancouver at the time collaborated to create these short-ish videos. They're sort of between 2 and 6 or 7 minutes, one for each year of, at the time, AIDS Vancouver's existence. And it really highlights like the incredible community that has been behind and with AIDS Vancouver since its inception, the ways that HIV and AIDS and stigma have, and like racism and colonization and homophobia have touched the lives of folks in our communities and some of the incredible community responses to that. It talks about the organizations that did HIV work that are no longer here because of the ways that funding has changed. So yeah, I think it's a really great introduction to some of the key concepts of HIV community organizing here in the Vancouver area.
Wonderful. And that kind of brings us pretty close to the end of the podcast. But the one question that I want to know is whether there's anything we haven't talked about yet that you still think that we need to have a conversation about.
Yeah, maybe I'll briefly talk a little bit about what we know about HIV education or HIV medication, which will do a few things. Help give you one fact if you're in the audience at home to share with somebody else after this podcast, and also help me highlight some of the advocacy work we've been doing with Health Initiative for Men and a number of other organizations. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I mentioned there's a lot of acronyms in HIV, and so one of the acronyms is ARV or antiretroviral. Viral. That's a type of medication that has been developed to treat the virus, and it works by reducing the amount of the virus in our bodies. That's great news for a few things. It means less inflammation in our bodies, and so basically like our organs are able to do much more of what they would even if the virus wasn't there. So it's really great for the individual health and wellness of a person living with HIV to take those medications. And they reduce the amount of the virus in a person's body so far that that person actually, as we've talked about, cannot pass HIV during sex if they've been on medication for 6 months or more and have had a consistently undetectable viral load. So this medication, you know, it was really 1996. So like over 10 years after the beginning of the crisis where like we really understood how to use medication to treat HIV effectively. If folks have seen movies or lived through this time, you know, we often see like handfuls of pills being taken on a regular basis by folks living with HIV in order to treat that virus. In the early 2000s, most people were able to take a single pill. So just like the science evolved in a way that a single pill each day could have those effects that we were talking about to support the lives of folks living with HIV. A pill a day can sound really easy when we say it that way, but if anybody takes vitamins on a regular basis, like I'm like, I took it yesterday, I probably took it today, but I'm not really sure.
And I feel that way with my hormones as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a lot of us that have relatable experiences of like, this is important to me. I think I did it, but I'm not sure. And the same is true for some folks living with HIV. Mm-hmm. One of the added pieces for folks living with HIV and maybe an experience around hormones I could imagine as well is not everyone wants everyone in their lives to know that that's something that they're taking. And right. So, you know, if I take my vitamin C at lunch and someone's like, what's that? I say vitamin C and everyone moves on and nobody asks a question. You could imagine if I was like, oh, my HIV treatment or my HIV prevention. So antiretrovirals are used also to prevent HIV. People might be like, oh, well, I didn't know you had HIV. Or why are you taking PrEP, the prevention piece? Like, are you a person who has that kind of sex or uses substances in that way? And, you know, then we're back into this conversation about stigma. So In 2020, so 4 years ago, actually in March, which is when we're recording the podcast, Health Canada approved a long-acting type of medication, the very first long-acting medication that's been available for use. And here in British Columbia, it's really difficult to access that compared to some of the other plans ways that HIV medication is provided. And this is like the single biggest innovation in HIV treatment, the ability to take it in a not every day, but to take it once this month and then not again until March, April, May. So it's up to every 2 months that folks can take this treatment option rather than every day. And for lots of reasons, daily medications are like hard logistically of, you know, I took it yesterday, did I take it today? Taking it with food is an important part of many of the HIV medications that are available. So, you know, taking it at lunch or at dinner, often people have others around when those meals are happening. But also for so many folks, it's a reminder of the time they got HIV, which, you know, could be a diagnosis, like the actual diagnosis moment that didn't feel very good. Could be, you know, a very violent experience of getting HIV, depending on what that looked like for folks. Could be a boyfriend that nobody wants us to talk about anymore. Could be somebody who's passed away when for folks who, you know, had that happen in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, it's really complicated. A pill is actually this whole bigger story of what it took to get to those pills. And so we really want to see long-acting treatment more available. We want to see folks living with HIV meaningfully involved in how and when that is available to other people. And so one of the things folks can also do is go to our website at ribboncommunity.org and contact your MLA to ask about that and provide a little bit more information. And we're continuing to work with all of the different folks that are involved in making those policies here in British Columbia and really look forward to a time where long-acting treatment is a reality for more folks living with HIV who want to choose that.
Right. And that's a matter of policies allowing for it to be more easily accessed in BC?
Yeah. So in BC, one of the things that we're really lucky about is that HIV medication is available at no cost to either people who are living with HIV and need that medication, and also for prevention for folks who sort of meet the criteria here in BC. And that's something that we're very grateful for and has been possible because of the work people living with HIV did to advocate for that sort of on a broader scale, but also the leadership of the BC Center for Excellence in HIV and AIDS. That organization creates all of the specific rules about who is eligible for what type of medication. Mm-hmm. And those, the current policy around long-acting medication, you know, we have some concerns about the criteria that are being used and how they've been developed. And we really see that they're not consistent with what other folks, other places are doing in other parts of Canada. And we'd really like to see that change.
And is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you wanted to bring up?
I think that's all of it.
That's everything?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining the podcast. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. I've definitely learned a lot, and I hope the audience has as well. This has been a social justice podcast. I'm your host, Nicholas Burling. I've been joined today by Sarah Chown from Ribbon Community.
Thanks, Nicholas.
Thank you. You've been listening to a social justice podcast hosted by Nicholas Burling, brought to you by The Flag Shop, and inspired by a social justice coloring book.